We're so very grateful. Very briefly this morning, I want to share a little bit about who we are and why we're here. And then shortly after that, I'll tell you how I got there. 30 years ago, I came to the foot of the cross and surrendered all of myself and all of my humiliation and all of my shame. With that transformation, I only had but one desire only in my life, to go forth to every nation, to stand before every generation, to proclaim the love and the faithfulness of Jesus Christ. For 30 years, God has sent me forth to honor that heart desire. But I must share with you that as I go, I do not go as a preacher. I'm not a preacher. And I don't go as a teacher either. No. As a woman in the church, I believe strongly that the men shall lead and the women shall follow. But if there would be one title that I would carry throughout my journey, it's that as a witness. Like that first risen Sunday morning, when Christ rose from the dead, he revealed himself to a woman and told her to go forth to make it known that he was alive. I follow her footsteps. But what you don't realize, the very thing, the heart desire to go forth, it would be the one and the only thing that would cause me the most pain and the most anguish in my life. 30 years ago, as I began that journey, Sue Thomas's ministry was formed. And while it was traveling and being able to see all the different denominations of all the churches around the world, I witnessed a very sad situation that our churches were declining from the reverence, from the holiness, the humbleness of God in the sanctuary, that we as a whole became one of the greatest social institutions of all times. And God laid it on my heart to pray for the church, that the church would return and rest beneath the shadow of the Almighty. Thus a burden was given to me to create a place where the silence would never be broken, where man could come to be renewed and restored and strengthened by that one-on-one with God. Thus they would be able to go back to the church with the strength and the wholeness that the church could be strengthened as a whole. This is how we came to Vermont in Tunbridge. Just a couple of miles down the road, there's two faithful women that have been here for the past 8 years, slowly carving out that mountain to create a retreat center that's called Waterbrooks, where the deer pants for the running waters, that the soul of man shall pant for the Lord thy God. Sir Thomas's ministry is composed of me proclaiming, of building water brooks, and one last but not the least, to be able to serve him by serving his people. That is with Operation Silent Night and And at this time, I would like to have a clip be shown to take you into the glimpse of what we do for the homeless. That's who we are. But I haven't always been that way. I've been profoundly deaf since the age of 18 months. I don't know why I wasn't sick, but very suddenly, I was watching TV with my three older brothers, and I turned up the volume full blast. My brothers turned it down, I turned it up, they turned it down. Mom and Dad ran into the room to find out what all the rock was about. They thought that I was getting tired and cranky, and they put me to bed that night. When they took me into bed, neither of them realized that it would be the very first long, silent night of the rest of my life. It wasn't until the next morning, as my mom was talking, sounds were going off, she realized I was totally oblivious to my surroundings. She grew concerned and called her neighbor, who was a nurse, and I was rushed to the hospital. There the doctors examined me and turned to my mother and said those words that would follow her the rest of her life. There's no hearing there. She's profoundly deaf. And from that moment on, doctors and educators alike began to share it would be best to put me in a deaf institution, that I'd never be able to learn to speak. I would have a hard time just simply learning. But what they didn't know, I was the only girl. I was the youngest. My parents had waited an awful long time for me to arrive, and they wasn't about to send me packing. So with that, they took a silent vow to do everything possible to enable me to live and survive in the world of sound. The first came in form of speech therapy, where for days and years, I sat in front of a mirror with my speech therapist, with my hand on her throat, and looking at her in the mirror. And as she formed her mouth, I would try to form my mouth the same way. And with my hand on her throat, I would feel the vibration. Then I would try to make those same vibes over and over, day in and day out. After 7 years, the therapist knew that she had given me all that she could, but there was still further work to begin. So they passed me on to a voice coach. With the voice lesson, they would get my voice to fluctuate up and down and up and down. And after the voice came dramatic reading for articulation and enunciation. So many, many years have gone into this voice, and yet I know I still talk funny. And people say, oh, no, you don't. Oh, but I do, and I know. Well, how do you know that? Well, I can be at the airport, a restaurant, a hotel, anywhere at any time, and somebody will always come up to me and say, where are you from? You really have an accent. It all depends on the way I wake up that day, which way the wind's blown. You know, I've been declared to be German. I've been South African, British. Really, the only ones that haven't claimed me yet is the Chinese and the Japanese. Okay? But who knows, that day might be coming. But the speech, it has followed me all the days of my life. But I remember that first moment. When I went to school that first day, when I was told to stand beside my desk and introduce myself to my classmates. And that day, as I stood so proudly, because I was finally in school with my brothers, I belted them. And with that, the entire class erupted in laughter. Those kids were laughing so hard that day, I had to turn around to find out why everybody was laughing. And when I couldn't figure it out, I just sat down. But I came to realize that every time I was to open my mouth to speak, the entire class would erupt in laughter. It didn't matter if I didn't speak or not, because I had 9 boys in my class, 9 of them, that waited for me by the drinking fountain in the playground, in the hallway, to push me, to poke me, to torment me, to laugh at me. But what these guys didn't know, I had 3 older brothers at home. And when they least expected them, I just punched them out. I guess maybe that was the beginning of my hostility. Maybe that was the very beginning of my own way, taking matters into my own hands at that ripe old age. I remember those school days very well. I remember sitting in the front row, watching my teacher ask all sorts of questions, like, what's the state capital to Ohio? And though I'd wait for the answer, only for her to break out into a big smile or shake her head and say, very good, what's the state capital to Pennsylvania? And there I was sat there thinking to myself, wait a minute, lady, what's the state capital to Ohio? I never realized that some smart kid behind me had raised his hand and gave the answer. As a result, I went through all of my school days getting just about all the questions. I never got the answer. And my grade began to show that I wasn't getting the answer. They became D's and F's. And one day, my teacher came up to me at my desk, and she looked very sad that day. And she reached down and she took my hand in hers and she led me out of the classroom. That day we walked down the hallway and this thing block was an awful long walk. And that was the day I entered another class. I entered what was known as the dumber class. And now all these kids had more ammunition to work with. I just didn't talk funny. I was now the dummy. And what was once my happiest moment of going to school, I grew to hate. Looking back on my childhood, I've often wondered if it wasn't for those 3 important elements that God placed in my life, if I might not have wiped out in that world of silence. But there was 3. First and foremost, my parents taught me that there was a God, that I was created in his image, and that God never makes the mistake. My mom embedded in me, as long as I held on to the hand of Jesus, he would lead me and he would guide me, and that there wouldn't be anything that I couldn't do or become. No, we were not a family that studied the word in the home. We only prayed on Sunday after the meal, and we went to church every Sunday. But the faith that was rooted into me, when I had no one else and no friends, I hung on to Jesus. The second one, you might have a little hard time understanding, because it was in form of a song. Did you get that? A song. I'm profoundly deaf. I don't have any recollection of music. But yet God would bring forth a song by at a very young age. My mom, who loved music, would pick me up and put me on her lap as she sat in the rocking chair, rocking back and forth, singing all of her favorite songs. And with my head on her shoulder, I could feel the vibrations. And if I really liked the song particularly well, my hand would sort of creep up, lay gently on her throat, that I could get all the vibes that I possibly could. It must have been around Christmas, because one of the first songs that my mom ever taught me was Silent Night. And I loved that song. And I can remember going to the principal's office and getting that spanking for punching all the kids out. And I would go back to my desk, and I would sit at my desk and look out the window and bite the lower part of my lip so the tears wouldn't start coming. And way down deep, I'd be singing Silent Night to myself, and I'd be okay. Or after a long, lousy day of school, I'd be going home on the school bus, sitting so close to that window that when I looked out, my nose would be all squished up against the glass so nobody would see the tears coming down my face. And I'd be singing Silent Night, and I'd make it home. The third element came in form of a skating rink. And my dad gave me lessons. And basically through the lessons, I skated forwards and backwards, and I went on to become the state champion in freestyle. And that saved my life, you know? I mean, all the kids thought I talked funny, and I was a dummy, but there wasn't one kid in my school that had a bigger trophy than I did, so forget them, you know? It was my saving grace for the moment. And I continued. And I remember going through school, and all I ever wanted was a friend. So by the time I reached my junior year, oh, I found those friends. Rebellious, disrespectful. I hung out with our own crowd. Those years were tremendous, turbulent, disrespectful years. And it was through a teacher my junior year that believed in me. Saw something in me that began to work with me one-on-one. That I went to college. 8 years it took me to get that college graduate degree. Not for him, but 8 years. And when I got it, I thought the world couldn't wait to hire me. But boy, was I wrong. Not one person would hire me. Why? I couldn't answer the telephone. Well, basically, I'm deaf. And if somebody comes in, she might misunderstand. She won't get it. I never got the job. I went back to the same hearing and speech center, pounded on their doors asking for a job. And I know they felt sorry for me, why they hired me. They didn't even have a job. But I became like a gopher, jack of all trades. And I can remember someday taking paper clips out of one box, sticking those paper clips in another box, and then putting them on the shelf. But I was only there for a few short months, when God had different ideas for my life. It was through a friend at the Hearing and Speech Center. They had a friend that lived in Washington, D.C. They had a friend that worked for the Department of State, who in turn had a friend that worked for the FBI. You following this? This is important. Through a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend, from Washington, D.C. to Youngstown, Ohio, I get word that the FBI is looking for deaf people. And if you don't think that I panicked, I thought to myself, what did we do? And they called me down that day, saying Thomas didn't do anything. They just want to know if you want a job. Do I want a job? Somebody's finally going to hire me for I have scratched that. I'm going to work for the federal government. On top of that, I'm going to be with the FBI. And I get to Washington, and it was like a dream come true. They took me around. They introduced me to all the agents. And then after all the introduction was over, they took me downstairs to the firing range. And that's where all the agents practiced their target shooting. That was their first mistake. Their second mistake. And when they handed me a Thompson 45 submachine gun, I shot up their entire shooting that day without even trying. It was a long time before they let me go back downstairs. And then I started my training to become what was known as a fingerprint examiner for the FBI. Within the first 5 minutes, I knew I had made the greatest mistake of my life. Someday we don't have anything else to do. Just take a look at your fingers real closely. All those lines of fingerprints. 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. It was my job to count every single one of those lines on that finger. and I can attest to the fact, if you've seen one, you've seen them all. Get me out of here. And I've been mumbling and grumbling to God, I can't take this anymore. Well, one day my supervisor comes running in, she's all upset, tells me to stop everything, that I have to go to the front office right away. The front office. There's only two reasons a person goes to the front office at the FBI: to be terminated from their job or to be interrogated by the FBI agents. I get down there that day, there's 9 men standing on the walls with 3-piece suits. They take one look at me, they tell me to sit down, and then the question started. And they went something like this: Ms. Thomas, we understand that you read lips to communicate and you do a really good job, but the only thing we want to know, just one thing, do you watch TV? Do I watch TV? That's all you guys want to know? I mean, is it a federal crime to watch TV? I confess, I watch TV. Well, how about, is it good? Do you have any problems with it? Well, yeah. I mean, no. I mean, I don't know. You know what I mean? You know, if the camera's on the person's lips and I can see their lips, I can read them, but so many times the camera's not even on the person, I have no lips to read, so I don't get it. Well, how about movies, Miss Thomas? Do you go to movies? Is it any better? Yeah, it really is. It's a lot better if I go to the movies. You know why? The lips are a lot bigger. On and on went the question, and I came to realize the FBI had a very large problem. They were working on a case in which they video filmed the suspect. But on this particular case, when the camera activated, the sound mechanism failed. They had all this film with the bad guys talking. They just couldn't hear it. And they wanted to know if I would watch it and write down any words. Sure, no problem. From that day on, I never went back to reading fingerprints. From that day on, I read lips for the FBI. And to sum up my job, I followed the bad guys around. I read the lips, told the good guys what the bad guys were saying, and they paid me to do it, too. Overnight, like the snap of a finger, I finally made it in the world of sound. Being invited to congressional parties, senator parties, I became known as the secret weapon of the FBI. And you would think, at that particular point in life, that you've reached the height of your profession, you have a good pay, this is what life is all about. What else is there? But for me, that wasn't the case. From the time I lost my hearing, being made fun of, being ridiculed, being isolated and lonely, all I ever wanted to do was to be able to fit in with people. Helen Keller said it best: blindness separates a person from things and objects. Deafness separates a person from people. Through the frustration, the alienation, there is the bitterness that started as a young child that basically was growing bigger and bigger and bigger as time went by. And now I'm up at the FBI, and I finally made it into the world's standards. But what the world didn't know was I was more frustrated and more lonely, more lonely than I had ever been. And it was at this particular point that I honestly believe that God made a terrible mistake. That it wasn't like my mom said, God doesn't make mistakes. I was convinced they made the greatest mistake. Why is that? When he created me with a heart that absolutely loves people. I love people. I mean, you know, that day when I stand before him, he opens the book of life and he goes down to find my name. He's going to see it. There's going to be a hyphen. It's going to say, God's greatest party animal. I love parties. I love to socialize. But you want to know something? I can't do it. I can't. I was a lip reader, one-on-one, I'm fine. I can do two people. They talk, you talk, you talk, you talk, I'm fine. Three people, I'm out of here. I can't be in groups. It's the very thing, the only thing that I want in life, I can't have. God made a mistake. I can't have. So I leave the FBI. I resign. On a mission to find God, to make him confess he made a mistake. The journey took me down to Columbia, South Carolina. I entered seminary. Now most people go to seminary. Either they become preachers or teachers or study the word or they become missionaries. I didn't go there for any of that. That wasn't my purpose. I was there to make God confess he made a mistake. And God was waiting. I'm going to ask you a question. Have you ever in your life wanted something so badly that you would do anything, absolutely anything, to obtain it? I did. Wanting something so badly, I took matters into my own hands, just leaving God out of this whole mess. I did what I had to do in order to get what I wanted to get. And I'm in seminary. And I told a lie. I went to one person that I knew in seminary and I told them an unbelievable lie that anyone could ever utter. I told her that I was dying. But I had a terminal disease. Why? Why would you do that? Because I thought if she believed me, she would want to spend as much time with me one-on-one and get to know me. And that's exactly what happened. But what I didn't realize is the first person I told that lie to, that it would fan out the 21 people. And surely I had no idea that the first time that I uttered that lie, that it would last for over 7 months. That lie totally consumed me and destroyed me. Where I was wasting away. Where all the professors on the campus thought that I was dying. That my mind became a state of confusion, that I couldn't do it anymore. That I went to that same person and said, make phone call, please. Call my advisor. I need to see him immediately and to make sure he has another faculty member with him. That next morning, I met with those two men streaming down my face, and I told the truth. I knew that I'd have to go to those 21 people and tell them the truth, and I was prepared for that. But what I didn't know is I would have to stand before the entire academic committee to confess my sin. The night before I was to meet that committee was the longest, darkest, quietest night of my life. The shame and the guilt was so unbearable that I began to pack my bags to run away. And as I'm packing my bag, my Bible fell on the floor and it fell open. And I bent over and I picked it up and I sat on the bed and I looked down. And then I looked at it again. Then I had this nervous laugh and giggle because I couldn't believe I was looking in the book of Hosea. Hosea. Did I ever go to Hosea before in my life? Did I even know there was a Hosea in the Bible? And I'm looking at Hosea, and Hosea's looking up at me, and I started to read. And that first line grabbed me and had my attention. And I realized God was speaking to me. And it wasn't just him talking. God was giving me a promise. The darkness, loneliness, most shameful night of my life, God spoke in the book of Hosea when he said, Hosea 14, 1 through 8, O Thomas, return to the Lord your God, for your sins have been your downfall. Take words and come back to me, for my anger will be forever gone. I will love you freely, Thomas. You will blossom as a lily. Your roots will go deeply into the soils of Lebanon, and your people shall return from exile far away and will rest beneath my shadow. 30 years have passed since that promise, and he's kept it. He's kept it. Morning by morning, new mercies I see. I've never seen his anger. You know, I'll be on the road and people will come up to me and they'll say, oh, you're so beautiful. I used to be so ashamed, thinking this big hunk of clay. And then God stopped me dead in my tracks and he said, remember, you will blossom as a lily. So if people can see my beauty, God has kept his promise. I have seen the fulfillment of Hosea 14 in every verse. Up to the last, that my people shall return from exile far away and will rest beneath my shadow. And it's with that that God gave me the burden to build water brooks, to be able to find the place where God's people can come alone, totally alone with God, to meet him face by face, to be renewed and restored, that they can come back to the church and strengthen. Yes, from that moment I had the one desire to go forth to every nation, to stand before every generation. And when I realized that God was calling me, I basically said, Lord, you know I can't do it. You know I talk funny. You know the laughter and the ridicule of all my life. Why? But Lord, if this is what you want, I'm going to make you a deal. I will go forth and I will talk funny. And I will make a fool out of myself. But you have to give me the words, that they be your words and they not be of my own accord. And so henceforth, we have traveled that journey together. This is our last Sunday with you. It's actually 2 weeks today. We leave for India. 30 years ago, when I first came out of that line, I had my passport, my visa, the funds. I was going to India to proclaim him. And right before I boarded that plane, the doors slammed shut, and I never went. 30 years later, God has opened the door and known that I was not ready back then, but I am ready and equipped to go. We need your prayers. Boy, do we need your prayers. In the 21 days, I'll be speaking 24 times on so many different topics. And what you don't realize, my speaking ceased for almost 3 years because of my affliction with multiple sclerosis and being near death. I am just returning to the journey once again. And we traveled to India, and immediately flying back, I go right to Minnesota to do a fundraiser for Teen Challenge, and we come back, and we pick up our cats, and we leave for New York to do a woman's retreat in New York. My father fed her best at a young age. It took her so long to learn to talk. Now we can't get her to shut up. And it's true. For what God has ordained, He will equip. We take you with us wherever we go. We feel Red Door has become our home. So that is a glimpse of the testimony and the true story of Sue Thomas, FBI. The story that Hollywood would never ever touch. And I've never ever gave the story. What about the song? Silent night, holy night, all is cold. Grace alone, not by law, I have been transformed. And through that transformation, I have a joy, an unspeakable joy that cannot be touched, that no man, no thing, no hour can ever take that away from me. That is what I want for his people. And so I leave you with the question, when did you go to the foot of the cross and totally die, totally, that he may live in you? Because only then we have begun the journey of walking with the Master and the faith, where nothing but nothing can rob your joy. Though the miles may come between you and me, though the voice may be the memory, we will carry you with us wherever we may go. That God leads, We'd appreciate your prayers. And downstairs, we have the brochure and the complete itinerary of where we're going. If God leads, pick us up and pray, God, for your time. Thank you.